The holiday season is a time when many people who cook very little during the rest of the year suddenly are spending a lot of time being creative in the kitchen. But without an understanding of the basics, things can go terribly wrong just when we want our creations to turn out perfectly. So today on Please Explain, we're going back to basics. We'll explore some truths and dispel some cooking myths. And we're thrilled to have with us once again Harold McGee, who has been thinking about and writing about the art and science of cooking for decades. He's the author of his most recent book, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes, which is published by Penguin Press. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks, Leonard. Great to be here.
This is, in a way, such a huge topic, but if we just try to begin with the absolute basics first. When you cook, how much does your equipment matter? What are the are there certain essential tools that everybody would need to have?
Well, it seems to me that apart from the obvious things like spoons and forks and pots and pans, two things that we often overlook are the things we use to measure and the things we use to measure not just ingredients but also heat, because cooking comes down to taking ingredients, putting them together in a particular proportion, and then adding heat to transform them.
So we should have a cooking thermometer always?
I think a thermometer can make a tremendous difference, especially for cooks who don't cook that often. I mean, if you cook every day, you kind of get a feeling for the way things work. But
just by looking at the way the food is changing.
Looking at it, smelling it, touching it, all those senses can give us information about what's going on, but they all require experience.
And why do you say spoons? I mean, aren't all those measuring spoons the same, all the measuring cups the same?
No, it turns out that spoons and cups are pretty unreliable as measures of ingredients.
Now you tell me.
It turns out that different brands actually hold slightly different amounts of these things. And it also turns out that measuring by volume is just a bad idea, because you're not really measuring the ingredient. You're measuring the space it takes up.
Well, Rose Levy Birnbaum did a book called The Cake Bible, in which she had everything weighed. But you can't weigh a tablespoon of salt.
Sure, sure.
You can?
In
is
fact,
that
that's
what
the
I should
best
be
way to do it, yeah, because you know what? A tablespoon of granulated salt is actually twice as much salt as a tablespoon of kosher salt. If you don't weigh it, you'd never know that. Equal volumes are completely different in the level of saltiness. So you could ruin a dish by using a tablespoon of one salt instead of the other.
So I should just have a little scale sitting there next to my stove at all times?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, it turns out to be much easier to measure by weight, because you can just keep adding things to the same container.
What about the stove? Is gas better than electric, as most of us think?
Well, it's certainly more comfortable to work with, because you can see the flame. You know exactly what kind of heat you're applying. But it turns out that gas is really inefficient. Less than half the heat that you generate, less than half the energy that you use actually goes into the pot. The rest of it goes into the air and warms the cook in the kitchen. So if you're concerned about using the energy efficiently, heating things quickly, electricity is much better than gas.
Because the pot and the pan are sitting right on the hot plate?
That's right, exactly.
Whereas so with the gas, there's a lot of space.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, of course, when Chinese people cook with a wok, they put the curved part in the bottom right into the flame.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And that is more efficient?
It is more efficient, but still you're losing a tremendous amount of heat.
What about some of the newer types of stoves, like induction burners?
Induction burners turn out to be the most efficient of all. They're like 95% efficient, and that's because they actually heat the pot, not anything else. If the pot's not above the burner, then nothing gets heated. So they're wonderful. The problem with them is that you have to get used to turning a knob and not seeing anything like a glowing flame or a glowing electrical element.
In fact, they don't even look like they're hot.
That's right.
Many of my food guests get huffy when I ask about using a microwave, and even if they admit to using one, they say they only use it to melt butter or chocolate.
Well, it turns out that microwaves, again, are very efficient, and partly because they actually penetrate into foods as they're heating them. And that means that you can cook vegetables much more quickly and with no added water And that means that you retain the vitamins much better.
But there are some that you retain the vitamins better.
Better.
Because if you cook them in a pan with some water, the nutrients, the vitamins are all going into the water?
They go into the water, and also the water is less efficient at heating.
But doesn't microwave cooking taste a little different?
It does. It does. But you can compensate for that by including a little butter or oil or something to provide the flavoring that you're looking for.
You talk about knowing your ingredients as mm-hmm. an important part of cooking. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I assume that we kind of know our ingredients, but when you're thinking about planning a meal, mm-hmm. what would determine whether you use spinach rather than Swiss chard, let's say?
Well, if you're one initial decision is, are you going to use frozen or fresh? And there are reasons sometimes to prefer frozen.
Really?
Yeah. Depending on the time of year and the vegetable. So, for example, I love lima beans. I never see lima beans in the store, fresh ones that are as fresh as what's harvested and frozen very quickly. So certain kinds of vegetables you can actually get in much better shape if they're frozen. But then assuming you pick fresh, it's just good to be able to look at vegetables in the produce bin and figure out which ones are the freshest. And I usually go for a category like greens and then look for in that category the freshest looking greens.
And what would the freshest be, the ones that don't look like they're wilted or the ones that have the brightest green color?
Yeah, exactly. And don't have brown along the edges, aren't broken, the leaves aren't broken. Things like that.
Because we're buying, a lot of the things we're buying are alive when we buy, and we don't even think of them in those terms.
That's right. That's right. Vegetables especially. So understanding that these things are still living, and then when you take them home, if you don't use them right away, treating them as such, treating them gently, refreshing them, putting them in a new bag and so on can help extend their useful life.
Would that also apply to eggs? Are they alive when we get them?
They are.
Because they definitely spoil. Yeah. Milk spoils, yogurt spoils.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all these things are and milk isn't an organism, so it's not alive in that sense, but it is filled with living things, and you need to take that into account.
How do you – okay, so we have some idea of how to pick the best vegetables, but what about meat? If we're cooking meat, I generally stay away from the stuff that looks brown.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good idea. You want meat to look fresh as well. You want it to be bright red. You want it to be the fat part should be nice and white or cream colored. You want to look to see if there's any kind of residue on the surface. Sometimes it can still be red, but it may have what looks like a paste, which comes from actually the sawing of the meat into slices, into steaks or chops.
Yeah. There are certain things that conventional wisdoms about cooking meat, for example, searing them to seal in the moisture.
Yeah.
Is that
– yeah.
You've said that's not true?
That's right. That turns out to be the mistaken idea of one guy in the 19th century who has whose idea is still believed these days, and it's just not true. The surface doesn't get sealed.
And then I read recipes for, let's say, when you're making a turkey, that insist that you baste on a regular basis. Others say no need to baste ever.
Yeah.
What about basting?
Well, basting can be useful because what it essentially does is slow down the cooking of whatever it is you're basting, usually the turkey breast. And that's a good thing because the turkey breast is sensitive. You don't want to cook it too quickly and too fast.
Well, then there's the whole debate over whether you roast things at a high temperature or low temperature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And actually, the best compromise is to start them at a very high temperature to get some nice browning on the surface and then turn the temperature way down so that the cooking through goes slowly and you have a much bigger window of opportunity to get it before it's overcooked.
My guest is Harold McGee, who is the author of any number of books about cooking and cooking science. The most recent one is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. It's published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a little while, we'll be taking your calls at 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And I have been, I just spilled some olive oil. You brought in some olive oil, and of course, clumsy me, I spilled it all over my notes. And I've been trying to put it back into the cup. I'm not sure that that's the most sanitary thing to be doing. But why did you bring the olive oil?
Well, we were thinking of something that might be interesting to taste. And the next column I'm doing for the New York Times, which will come out next week, is about oils. And something that I learned in the course of doing that is that a lot of the oils that we assume are good stuff, olive oils in particular, turn out to be not so good.
Not so good in what way?
They're old and stale and rancid. And most consumers, it turns out, don't recognize that because that's all we know.
Well, Italians, the people like Lou DiPaolo, who sells olive oil, always says, once you open the bottle, use it right away.
Yes.
The problem is people sometimes let it sit in the pantry for a long time.
Yeah.
But you can't put it in your refrigerator.
No, you can put it in your fridge, but it turns out that doesn't help that much because for particular chemical reasons, it actually enhances the degeneration of the oil, the cold temperatures.
Is it only true of olive oils? What about some of the other safflower oil, grapeseed oil, canola oil?
It's true of all of them as well, I'm afraid. So the best thing you can do is buy in small quantities. Cover them up with, if they're in a clear bottle, with some aluminum foil to block the light because light causes damage. And then, as Lou says, use it quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the reason for using one rather than the other is that olive oil gets hot very fast. And some others, the Chinese, for example, or Asians, usually prefer to cook with peanut oil because it takes a lot longer for it to reach a real high point. Butter and olive oil get hot very fast?
Well, actually, there's a difference between the rate at which things heat, and all oils and butter are pretty much the same. What's different is the temperature at which they begin to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's much more important that the oil be fresh than it be one particular oil or another. Butter is the one counterexample to that. So butter will burn at a lower temperature than oils do. But if the oil is fresh, you can heat it to 450, 475. If it's not fresh, it'll start to smell at 350.
Now, what am I going to do with these three cups of olive oil that have been put in front of me?
Well, these are three oils from three different countries and three different styles and I think three different prices, although I'm not sure about that since I didn't buy them. Mm-hmm. But I thought we could just taste them and compare the flavors and see whether they're all good or maybe one's not so good.
Well, they're numbered 1, 2, 3, so... Uh-huh. I know which one to start with.
And the first one is an Italian oil.
Has a little bit of a peppery aftertaste.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next one is a little blander.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have that peppery taste. Maybe we should have started off with the blander one.
Right, right. In fact, this first one made you cough. I just about coughed. And so olive oil enthusiasts will talk about one cough oils, two cough oils.
Really?
Yes. And it turns out the stuff that makes you cough is good for you. It's an anti-inflammatory that was discovered by a taste scientist who, when he had his first sip of really fresh olive oil, noticed that catching in the back of the throat and immediately recognized that it was exactly the same thing that happens when you have ibuprofen in your mouth.
Wow.
And he thought there must be something like that in olive oil, and he was right.
So the first one probably is better than the second one, or at least better for your health. It doesn't mean it's necessarily better for cooking.
That's right. And the second one is French, and it's a very different style, much milder and, as you say, blander. And I would say a little bit stale. But it's been harvested from older olives, more mature olives, and that's why the flavor is rounder and gentler.
And what is the third one? Probably Spanish or Greek?
The third is Spanish from Catalonia.
Somewhere in between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But not – well, a little bit of pepper.
Three.
Well, that's just because we're using the Italian. Oh no, it got very peppery in its aftertaste.
Yeah, yeah. The pepperiness takes a while to develop, and it catches you in the back of the throat.
Well, olives never really ripen in the way that other fruit ripe. Do we call them fruit?
Yes, olives are fruits, and in fact, they do ripen exactly the same way that other fruits
but
do.
But you can't just eat them. You always have to treat them.
That's right, and that's because they're protecting themselves. They don't want animals like us to eat them.
So if we have an olive oil, are we just getting the olive, or are we also getting the thing that they've been treated with, the lye or whatever they put it in?
Oh, no. If you're pressing olive oil, then by law, you can't do anything to the olives.
Oh, you just got to put the – and then the first pressing is the extra virgin?
Yes.
And is that necessarily any better than the second pressing or the third pressing?
It generally is, yes. It's purer. It has more of the oil and nothing else. And the lye treatment is for table olives. It's for olives that you're going to eat.
Interestingly, the Italian was the cheapest. The French one was the most expensive.
Huh. Well, and I would put, I think, the Spanish oil at the top of my list and the French oil at the bottom.
Mm.
How about you?
Well, yeah, if at least in terms of this taste test.
Mm-hmm.
But we use olive oil in so many different ways. We use it in cooking. We put it in salad dressings. And nowadays, unfortunately, you can't go into a restaurant and get butter anymore.
And often the oil that you're served in a restaurant is definitely rancid because it's been sitting out so long.
And they're buying it a huge – many people think that they're doing a smart thing by buying those big cans.
Yeah, big mistake.
What about some of the other things? MSG is something that you write about. MSG is probably one of the most vilified of all the things that we've seen in Asian cooking. How bad is it for us?
It doesn't seem to be bad for us at all because it's been suspect. It's been studied hundreds of times in many different countries around the world, and it's come out with a clean bill of health. And it's part of what makes things like Parmesan cheese and tomatoes so delicious. It occurs naturally in foods.
There are – one of the secrets to cooking well is to know how to substitute things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you have a recipe for buttermilk, can you use sour cream? Can you use yogurt? Will you get the same effect?
You'll get some of the same flavors, but because they vary tremendously in their fat content, that's going to make a big difference. If you're looking for richness and you use buttermilk instead of sour cream, then you're going to be disappointed.
But that can apply to anything. Thomas Keller told me that that eggs on the West Coast are a different size than they are in the East Coast. And so when he's giving recipes to his chefs in the French Laundry or per se here, he actually has to give them a different number of eggs.
Yeah. No, it's true. The variability, because these are all natural materials, is tremendous. You have to take that into account.
So when we just are following a recipe to bake something, we're really taking a chance. We have to know whether the cookbook writer lives in Los Angeles or in New York?
Well, USDA sizes are nationwide, and you can rely on them on both coasts. But I think what Thomas was talking about, that his suppliers of very special eggs have chickens that produce in different sizes, and he has to deal with that.
There is also the matter of when people just say salt and pepper to taste.
Mm-hmm.
That's led, in some cases, to rather salty and peppery dishes.
Yes.
In my household.
Yeah. Or very bland ones, because it's true that different people have very different sets of receptors for tasting foods.
Or pinches of salt.
Yeah.
So how do we what is a pinch of salt?
It's a small amount, so small that you can't measure it in a standard teaspoon. But if you have a scale, you can measure it down to the gram.
Now, some people brag about New York water tasting better than water in other parts of the country. Does that affect the way our food tastes? Because we use water in many of the things that we cook.
That's right, yeah. In tea and coffee, it's 98% of the drink. So it depends a lot on the food you're talking about and also on the city you're talking about. I grew up around Chicago, where the flavor of the water is pretty awful. In San Francisco, where I am now, where it comes from the mountains, it's pretty good. And beyond the flavor, there's the mineral content, the hardness of the water. If you live in a place that has very hard water, that can actually slow the cooking of vegetables down to the point that you may think they're never going to get soft.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take calls and also read some of the things that people have written in to our our comments on our show page. But I also want to address the whole matter of organic and local and whether we can assume that those foods are better and better for us and going to taste better. Mm-hmm. My guest is Harold McGee. He is the author of any number of books and also writes for the New York Times. His latest book is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. It's published by Penguin Press. And again, our number here, 646-829-3985. Okay, 646-829-3985. Start calling now. We're back with Harold McGee, whose latest book is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. It's published by Penguin Press. This is a Please Explain segment. Okay, before we get to some of these callers, just let's address the whole organic food thing because it's still a subject of so much debate.
Yeah.
Is organic food better for us?
Not necessarily. Sometimes, but not necessarily. And it's because the healthfulness and the flavorfulness of foods is so dependent on their freshness. So if you're getting something that's very fresh, the farmers brought it to the market that day, it's still got the dew on it, it's probably going to be wonderful, unmatched. But if it's been harvested a few days ago and been on the back of a truck for a while, it's going to be as bad as anything else. So it really does depend on how it's been handled.
Well, Jan or Ian from New York City.
Ian.
Hi, Ian. You're on the air. You have a question about pesticides?
Yeah, I have a question. So I really enjoy my green leafy vegetables, and, you know, they're really high in iron and vitamin A. But I recently found out that, you know, since they grow close to the ground, they can be high in pesticides. And I was told to buy frozen because it's blanched, and therefore you lose the pesticides. But I'm thinking you also lose some of the vitamins as well.
So this is a two-parter. What about washing?
Yeah, washing is not going to get rid of much from the surface of vegetables. It turns out that bacteria and chemicals both end up in the tissue itself, not just on the surface of the tissue. So washing will take off the obvious grit, but not anything else.
So the cleaning, the blanching, what about the blanching?
Well, blanching is a little different because you're then heating it at the same time, and that will remove some of the, if there are chemical residues, it'll remove some of them, but not all of them, and it will at the same time remove some of the nutrients.
Thank you for calling us, Ian.
Thank you.
I've always, I love local strawberries during the summertime, but I sometimes can taste the pesticides in the strawberries in the green market, and I've gone from farmer to farmer asking them whether they use pesticides or not. Most of them do, a few don't, and the difference in the price, of course, is extraordinary.
Yeah. Now, if you can taste it, then that's way too much, and you want to find another supplier.
Well, you mentioned cooking as a way of killing germs. Cooking kills all food poisoning microbes, but don't some microbes survive boiling temperatures?
Yeah, they do, and that's something that it's important to keep aware of when you're taking care of leftovers, because it turns out that a fair number of microbes survive boiling by becoming spores, little seeds that are resistant to heat, and when the food is done cooking and begins to cool down again, but it's still nice and warm, those spores can hatch and the bacteria can start to multiply. And in a few hours, that can be a problem.
In response, I guess, to our early conversation, a listener asked how long you should keep olive oil before it'll go bad.
It's impossible to say. And the surest way to tell is to taste it. If it tastes a little bit cardboardy or painty or fishy, get rid of it.
Alden, I guess, in Inwood says, I thought that the red color of meat in grocery stores was primarily food coloring.
No, that's the color of the muscle, the pigment in the muscle that stores oxygen so that the muscle can work.
Debbie asks, what's the purpose of paprika? I hear it's just used for color.
Well, bad paprika maybe, but good paprika has a lot of wonderful flavor.
It has punch, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's take another call. Robert from New York, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question that's sort of the same question about two things. If you buy frozen meat from the butcher or from the grocery store, like chicken, or fresh, and then you put it in the freezer, how long should you keep it, or how long can you keep it?
Well, I'm afraid to say, depends on how cold your freezer is and things like that and how old the chicken was before you bought it.
But does the freezing change the structure of the flesh?
It does, and it also causes the fat in the chicken slowly to become rancid. So the chicken will be safe to eat for years, but it's not going to taste good after a couple of months.
But isn't a lot of the poultry we buy frozen anyway, or at least frozen before it winds up in the store?
That's right. And the stuff that looks as though it's fresh, in fact, has often been frozen first and then thawed.
So do we have to ask about that?
Yeah, that's the best thing to do.
I'm sorry to bring you such bad news.
Okay. Can I also ask you about spices? How long is it okay to keep, like, those spice jars? Should you replace them?
Yeah. Again, the best bet is just to taste them every once in a while. The green ones can begin to taste like hay after a few months. The seed spices keep much better, and you can keep those for a year or two.
But that is a problem. I know I have a lot of spices that I don't use a lot, but every so often a recipe calls for it, and I'm not sure whether I'm actually improving the dish or not. Let's take another call. Claire from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about brining chicken, which I picked up by watching Food Network. Chef A.B., I won't mention his name. Anyway, I have found that it helps a cook like me a lot, that the chicken, the breast always remains flavorful and moist, even when I overcook, which is typical of me. What do you think about that?
Do you think Alton Brown overcooks?
No, I wish. I've really learned some things from him, by the way.
Yeah, no, I think he's a wonderful educator. I love his show. But I'm not as big a fan of brining as he is. And the reason for that for me is that one of the things I love about roasting chickens, turkeys, birds of various kinds is that they make wonderful pan juices. And if you brine those things first, then the pan juices are just too salty to make a nice gravy from.
But don't you get a moister chicken?
You get a moister chicken, but the moistness is actually salty tap water. When you think about it.
may I ask a second part of the question?
Go ahead.
Because I found that I do wash the chicken afterwards. And to my taste buds, it has not tasted salty. But I was wondering how much salt is retained, because I'm not supposed to have a lot of salt.
Yeah.
And are we just filling the chicken up with a lot of water? We're not putting a lot of salt in it.
Uh-huh. I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it turns out that if you're getting an effect that means that the chicken is moister, then that doesn't happen without salt. So you may not taste it, but it's there doing its work, which is helping to retain the water.
By the way, I brine my chicken, and I'll swear by it. So, you know, different strokes for different folks. Our number here is 646-829-3985. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a diabetic, and I like to bake. I want to substitute sugar with agave, but I know the one's dry, one's moist. Where could I find out what adjustments to make, or could you tell me?
That's a good question, and I don't know offhand what the equivalence would be. And also, of course, you'd have to adjust the moisture, the moist ingredients, as well as the solids.
Yeah.
I think probably it's the best thing to do is just to experiment a bit yourself. Start out with a one-to-one replacement, and you might need to add a little bit more. The thing about fructose, though, and that's what agave syrup is made of, is that it's sweeter than table sugar. And so even though it's diluted with water, it's going to have a sweeter taste, and you may not need as much.
Thank you for calling us.
Thank you.
Susan in Manhattan asks, from day to day, I find the oven temperature varies widely. One day I set the thermostat to 375, and then the thermometer registers 350 on other days. It's spot on. Could there be a variance in the gas coming through the line, or could it be that my oven or my thermometer need to be adjusted?
Well, it is true that gas pressure can vary from day to day, and that could have an effect. Also, the ambient temperature of the room could have an influence. But the best thing that that I think one can use for checking on oven temperatures is one of these new non-contact thermometers, which you just point and shoot and get an instant temperature reading. Often you can't even trust the thermometers that you're using to monitor the thermostat.
Wait, so you do it outside the oven?
No, you open up the oven and point this at the wall or the floor or whatever part of the oven you're interested in, and you get a reading of that temperature.
And how much would one of those things cost?
You can get these for as little as $30. Better ones for more. If you want to measure the temperature of your pizza stone, for example, it costs a bit more. But they're very useful.
Yeah, it's a small thing. It looks like a lot of fun. I have to get one immediately. we have a call from Connor from Brooklyn.
Hi.
Yes,
Hi,
Connor.
Thank you. Yeah, I have two questions. The first one's pretty simple. I was just wondering, does the amount of time olive oil sits on a shelf unopened matter in this whole issue of olive oil going bad?
And a listener, by the way, wants to know about storing herbs, if you don't open up the jar, do they remain fresh?
Mm-hmm.
Olive oil, actually.
I'm adding to that because we're talking the same thing here.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So it turns out that the answer is the same for both. Even if the container is unopened, whether it's herbs or an oil, the contents are slowly degenerating. They're getting stale, and that's because the temperature is warm, and there are traces of reactive ingredients in there that are going to just affect the flavor.
Well, a listener wonders whether you can do the thing that some people do with wines and use a vacuum to take some of the air out. Would that work?
Well, and some of these oils are now packed under nitrogen gas to do exactly that kind of thing. The thing is, though, one of the things you can do to maximize the shelf life of oils or herbs is not to leave them exposed to light, because light, it turns out, does as much damage as temperature and oxygen. So if they're clear bottles, it may be a beautiful thing to look at, but as you're looking at it, you're slowly contributing to the staleness of the contents.
Thank you so much for your call. Elaine in Baltimore writes, does veggie wash remove the waxes and pesticides better than just water or dish soap? When I use it on peppers, it seems to remove the wax.
Mm-hmm. It can help. It can help. It can make a difference, a quantitative difference, but it's not going to get everything.
Now, I'm sure that I have overlooked some really important facts in keeping this discussion going, and listeners may not call in with the question that should be asked. Are there certain things that we haven't addressed that everybody should know?
Well, I think we've actually covered a couple of the things that have come to my mind. That is to say, measuring accurately both ingredients and temperature by using a scale and good accurate thermometers. That can make a tremendous difference. And then remembering, for the sake of the healthfulness of the food that we produce, that it's really important to get leftovers back into the fridge within 4 hours of having taken them out of the oven.
Should we, if we have leftover chicken or turkey, should we take it off the bone? Does the bone create some kind of bacterial reaction?
No. In fact, I would recommend not taking it off the bone, because the less you handle it, the less chance you have of making things worse. So just...
I was told the opposite. You know, you must take that meat off the turkey.
Uh-huh.
Not true.
I don't know who told you, but I would disagree.
Well, I'm glad to learn that. A listener is concerned about the radiation that comes out of microwaves.
Mm-hmm. So the radiation that comes out of microwaves is essentially the same radiation that comes out of our cell phones and our wireless internet networks. So it's really not something to be concerned about.
We asked listeners on Facebook to share the food myths they're curious about. And Alexa asks about the link between botulism and home canning. She has a terrible, irrational fear of it.
Well, botulism bacteria thrive only in the absence of oxygen, and that's what canning involves, is filling containers and heating them, and so you have to do it carefully and correctly in order to make sure that that won't be a problem.
John on Facebook wants to know about cooking octopus with a wine cork. It seems like a myth, but he knows some chefs swear by it.
Yeah, so we've tested that a number of times at the French Culinary Institute in New York, and we've not found any evidence that that's true.
So I can't even imagine that it would be, but some of these food myths just do endure, don't they?
Yeah.
I'd love to have you back sometime soon to talk about some of the other things in your book. But thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain. Harold McGee writes for The Times and other publications and is the author of Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. It's published by Penguin Press. And it's been a lot of fun, Harold.
Thank you, Leonard. For me, too.